yesterday's prophecies for today's world.
But greater is he who is in you than he who is in this world. The Holy Spirit dwells in every believer, and he is in you, and you need not be afraid.
And now, Hal Lindsey's Bible study, the book of John.
John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. I call it the adultery plot. So let's take a look at John chapter 8. Actually, if you will note in most Bibles, I've got before me a New American Standard Bible. Do you note that in John chapter 7, verse 53, that there's usually a bracket there? Okay, the bracket goes all the way to the end of verse 11. Notice that? That's because most manuscripts do not include this passage in the original. And I think we can answer that. First of all, we're going to let this passage stand on its own merits, and you determine whether it's supposed to be in there or not. But first, if you've studied the church fathers, that is, the church leaders in the church at large in the first, second, third century, especially, you'll find that there's an amazing thing that took place shortly after the apostles and the eyewitnesses who were disciples of Jesus died. Legalism started sneaking into the church in full steam. And it really exploded by the time of the second century. Now, many theologians believe, and I really believe this, that what happened is that some of these legalistic theologians in the church said, you know, this really isn't what Jesus said. It shouldn't be in there. This will encourage women to commit adultery because it's soft on adultery, they say. And so it's obvious that in the earlier times, and most of the manuscripts range somewhere at the middle of the first century onward, it's obvious that somebody tampered with this text. But I'm going to take this text at face value, and we're going to study it tonight. Now, in John 7, verse 53, it said, and everyone went to his home. And actually, this chapter, with its dramatic and powerful, it's Jesus' most powerful presentation of his claims of being Messiah, when he made his dramatic shouting a statement before all the people of Israel in Jerusalem in verses 37 through 39. So this closed off that day. And what happens is in John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, is the next day after that. Okay? And that sets the atmosphere for what was happening here. Okay? In verse 1, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, where he stayed. In verse 2, and at dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. Now, this was his custom, but this would have been a very important morning for him, because he has just, in the most powerful way, the most explicit way, stood up at the height of the great ceremony at the eighth day, the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. And when they were in prayer, in silence, and they were praying for the Messiah to come and to pour the Spirit on Israel like water on the desert, he leaped up and screamed, he who thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He that believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water. So he was saying, what you're praying for, I am. And everyone would have heard that. that was part of the leadership, everybody. So this is the next day after that. So what kind of an atmosphere would have existed then? Well, it was one of intrigue, danger. Everything was uptight because all the people knew the religious leaders were out to kill Jesus. They were afraid to do it openly without an excuse, so they were plotting and scheming, and they had been for some time now. But after what he did the day before, they were determined to kill him. So because of his popularity with the crowds, they didn't dare just kill him, but they wanted to find an airtight case where they could put him especially in opposition to the law of Moses. And so as he was teaching that morning in this atmosphere, it says in verses 3-5, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and kept saying to Jesus, the present tense here, this means they were jabbing at him and they were prodding him to say something about what they were doing. So just picture this for a minute. They bring this poor woman in. She's quivering with fear and embarrassment. And they interrupt a Bible teaching that Jesus was doing and just marched right into the middle of that crowd with this woman. They were haughty. They were unfeeling. And they had no mercy or any feeling of concern for the woman. She was just a piece of bait that they were using. And they came in with arrogance because, you see, they were sure that at last they had an airtight case to put against him. And they had a situation where they could put him on the horns of a dilemma. And so they were very confident that they had just what they had been looking for to trap him. And so they come in with this woman, and it says, and they kept saying to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now, in the law of Moses, he commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" What have they done there? They have immediately pitted him against Moses. And you know, from reading the New Testament, how they had exalted Moses above God. I mean, they worshiped Moses. And the law of Moses was something that was the center of everything to them. And so they very confidently kept jabbing at him and trying to needle him to give an opinion and to condemn this woman, or if he let her go. See, either way, they felt they had him, because if he condemned her, then what would happen to all of the times when he said, "I have come not to save the well, but the sinners"? And I have come, and they constantly condemned him for eating with sinners and for being the friend of sinners. He was known as that. And so he was known as one who came showing love, the love and mercy of God. He said, he quoted the prophets when he said, God told Israel, "I will have mercy and not sacrifice." And so if he just condemned this woman out of hand, then it would betray everything he had sought to do to show God loved them and wanted to save them. But on the other hand, if he sided with the sinners, then he was up against the law of Moses, which said, and I'll read you a couple of passages out of many that I could read here, looking at Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, it says this: if there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, or one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 22, if a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. If he just were to go against that and say, you know, I'm not going to condemn her, then he would have broken the law of Moses. So he was faced with what seemed like an airtight case against him, one that either way was going to give them an excuse to get rid of him. Now, there are certain questions that I have as I look at this. First of all, it's obvious, because it's even noted here in John's statement on this. And they were saying these things in order to test him, in order that they might have grounds for accusing him. So the motive is clear. So Jesus looks at them, and by their manner and the way they've done this, he knew that they were not just coming in to vindicate the righteousness of the law and to clear unrighteousness out of Jerusalem and Israel. They were there to get him. So their concern wasn't about upholding law. Their concern was the use of the law to get him and kill him. Now, there are certain questions that arose in my mind as I looked at this situation. And I'm sure if you think about this, you would ask some questions too. First of all, where is the man who was involved in this adultery? Did you note that in those two statements that I read, it said they both shall be put to death? Where is he? All right, there are certain things this also shows. First of all, it shows what a low view the Pharisees and the teachers in the law of that day had of women. You see, they didn't care about this woman at all. To them, she was just somebody they could use to get at Jesus. So they showed no heart, no concern, nothing. They looked at her only from the standpoint of the law, not from the standpoint of humanity. And this is what Jesus had said before, something they couldn't get through their heads. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You see, he always was seeking to get them to bring the rational moral issue into understanding what the law was for. Now, this also shows that there's another problem. In order for someone to be condemned by the law, what do you have to have? At least two eyewitnesses that would swear to their testimony. Where were they? Well, the religious leaders came in and asserted this, but they didn't bring a witness to back it up. I'm sure there was at least one witness who was there, because he's probably the adulterer. But he didn't want to stand up and say anything. Another question. How did they know the exact time that this act was going to be committed so that they could be right there on hand and catch them in the very act. Yeah, that's not usually easy to do. And how could they have found this out at such a convenient time, just at the time Jesus is teaching in the morning at the temple? You see, this smacks of a plot. It smells like a plot all the way through. Now, I want you to look at the way Jesus responds to this. Notice, Jesus doesn't speak to them. He looks at them. They kept firing these accusations at him and demanding that he would say, you know, Moses says this, now what do you say? You could just hear the sarcasm, I'm sure, dripping in their voice. He doesn't answer them a word. Now that's divine wisdom. You know why? They wanted him to say something, because it, no matter what he said, it would have gotten them into a debate, which they could have steered around enough, no matter what he said, to bring something to accuse him with. So he didn't answer them. Now, most of us would start answering and trying to debate with them. Jesus didn't. He just looked at them. And then he did something that was awesome when you really step back and look at who he is. Because it says, but Jesus stooped down and started to write on the ground with his finger. He whose finger originally wrote the law of Moses on the stone was the one who was putting his finger on the ground. He who gave the law of Moses was the one who stooped down to write on the ground. And Jesus knew how to use drama. He knew how to use silence and build curiosity. And his refusal to speak, and then this act of bending down and writing on the ground, everyone was trying to see, what is he writing? What do you think he wrote? I have a pretty good idea what he wrote. He doesn't tell us, but I have a pretty good idea. You see, if you, I've had the opportunity to go through a lot of books and on a few occasions talk to rabbis about the Old Testament and the law and so forth, and at least to look up all of the volumes that there are on rabbinical decisions about the law and to define down into minutiae how you're to keep it. But do you know there's one commandment there's hardly anything written about? The 10th commandment. Do you know that? Does anyone know what the 10th commandment says? Huh? Thou shalt not covet. Right. Now that's something you can't do on the outside, is it? It can only be done in the heart by the motives. Does that give you a clue why they didn't write much about it? Because everything in the law was externalized by the rabbis. Because that's something they, as a, in their own flesh, could, by extreme effort, keep. And they did keep it on the outside. But that's why Jesus, who could see on the inside, said, you whitewashed tombstones. On the outside, you're beautiful. But on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. I believe Jesus wrote this. I believe the first time he bent down to write, he wrote twice. The first time he bent down to write, I believe that he wrote part of the 10th commandment, which says, you shall not covet, literally, lust after your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant. Now, in the original, this has the connotation of lusting after a man's wife sexually, or a manservant or a maidservant sexually. So when he wrote that on the ground, he was setting his own trap. They set a trap for him. Now he's going to set a trap for them. And let me tell you something. Only God could have come up with this. I don't care what they say about it. It's not in the original. I believe it is, because only God could have come up with this. He set a trap. And the trap, they came to trap him with the law. So he turns around and uses that very law to trap them with their own conscience. So in essence, he was writing on the ground. Then he straightened up and looked at them as they were thinking as what they had read. He was looking at them with that piercing gaze that he had, as if to say, how are you doing on that one? And there's something else we got to factor into here. When Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, it says that all kinds of the top religious teachers were there hearing him. Did he make a comment about this in the Sermon on the Mount? Yes, he did. Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 and 28. When he told them, he said, you have heard it said by the elders, or literally he's talking about the sages, the rabbis of the past who kept writing and writing about the law. You've heard it said by the sages, literally, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that a man who looks lustfully after a woman has committed adultery in his heart already. They knew about that. So all he had to do was write what the law said in the 10th commandment, that part. And it would immediately trigger one of the things that they thought they could trap him on, that he had said that breaking the law about committing adultery was something that was considered by God as breaking it if you lusted in your heart after a woman. When they kept on, verse 7, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, if one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw the stones. And then he looked back at what he had written. And then he looked straight at them. That's the only thing he said. Now, does this mean that in order for anybody to judge sin, they've got to be perfect? No. But that's why I believe he used part of the 10th commandment, because literally what he was saying, if any one of you is without sin in this matter, let him be the first to throw the stone. And then he stooped back down again. Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Now what did he write the second time? I believe he wrote the second time, you shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. That's the end of the 10th commandment. So, right away, this gets to them. And it's interesting that at that point, people began to shut up. And it says that, verse 9 and 10, at this point, those who heard, literally, those who heard and saw what he wrote, began to go away one at a time, the older ones first. Why do you think the older ones left first? son, you could tell them, can you? I can't. Because the older ones have a lot more lusting and coveting on their record than the young ones. And they were a lot more involved than the younger ones. And so, one by one, they quietly slipped away. Now, he's only said one statement to all of the accusations, all of the things they were throwing at him. He's only said one thing, and all of a sudden, they start fading away. Oh, I love Jesus. And after a while, Jesus straightened up and he asked her, "Woman, where are they?" Now, I want you to look at this from the woman's point of view. Yeah, she's a sinner. And she was terrified. They cared nothing about her. They just cared about snaring a trap.
Join us next week for the continuation of Hal Lindsey's Bible study of the Book of John. You can find more of Hal Lindsey at his website, www.hallindsey.com. There you can access our video and article archives. Visit our online store for Hal Lindsey CDs, books, and other specialty items.
Hal Lindsey is pleased to present his first ever audiobook, Faith for Earth's Final Hour, read in its entirety by Joel Weldon, professional voiceover artist.
Recognizing the truth of Titus 3:5, not by works of righteousness, which we have done, but according to his mercy, he saved us.
This audiobook is now available for purchase in three formats: a 9-CD set for $44.99 plus shipping and handling, a USB flash drive for $44.99 plus shipping and handling, or as an audio download from hallindsey.com for $24.99.
To support this program, send your tax-deductible gift to Hal Lindsey Media Ministries, P.O. Box 470-470, Tulsa, Oklahoma, 74147. You can also support this ministry online. Visit hallindsey.com or call 1-888-RAPTURE.